This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Now we turn to the rights of students and the authority of school boards. This year marks the 40th anniversary of Island Trees School District versus PICO, the first and only time the Supreme Court considered the question of book removal in school libraries. Our correspondent Micah Loewinger tracked down the main plaintiff from this nearly forgotten case.
You know, we're being taught in schools that book banning only occurs in totalitarian countries. And you wake up one day and you're not allowed to read a book in your own school because it was removed from all the shelves.
This is Stephen PICO, who would end up finding his way to the Supreme Court some years later. But in 1976, he was still a 17-year-old student at Island Trees High School on Long Island in New York. He discovered his life's calling the day he learned that a list of books had been removed from his school district's libraries.
From the high school library, 9 books were banned. The Naked Ape by Desmond Morris. Down These Mean Streets by Peary Thomas.
They include such books as Soul on Ice by Eldridge Cleaver. The book banner said that he was anti-American and that he hated white women. And then there's Slaughterhouse-5 by Kurt Vonnegut Jr. He made the list because he called Jesus a man with no connections. And then there's The Fixer by Bernard Malamud. They said that that was anti-Semitic.
There was also Best Short Stories by Black Writers, an anthology edited by Langston Hughes that featured work by James Baldwin.
Go Ask Alice by an anonymous author.
Laughing Boy by Oliver Lafarge.
Black Boy by Richard Wright.
And A Hero Ain't Nothing But a Sandwich by Alice Childress.
Also from the junior high school library, one book was banned, an anthology called A Reader for Writers, edited by Jerome Archer.
The Island Trees School Board targeted these books after 3 of its members had traveled upstate for a conservative conference run by a group called Parents of New York United.
They went outside my community and found a list on a table at a meeting of objectionable books. And then they went back to our library and they searched the school and said, okay, well, we found 11 books on this list. We're going to remove them. Now, what does that mean? It means no student ever objected to any of these books. It means that no parent in the community ever objected to any of these books. No one in the community had objected to any of these books.
Would it have mattered if people were objecting to the books?
In principle, no. But in my case, it came from a political movement that was going across the United States. And many people today can understand what I'm talking about. The school board, which is publicly elected, sent out a press release. The press release said, while at a conference, we learned of books found in schools throughout the country which were anti-American, anti-Christian, anti-Semitic, and just plain filthy. To date, what we have found is that the books do in fact contain material which is offensive to Christians, Jews, Blacks, and Americans in general. In addition, these books contain obscenities, blasphemies, brutality, and perversion beyond description.
An interesting wrinkle in all this is that Stephen PICO had gotten to know the members of the school board personally because he was student council president. And when he challenged them on their decision, he started to suspect that they were cherry-picking passages.
I had read, I'd say, a number of the books that were removed. I think the one that probably touched me the most was Go Ask Alice.
Hello, Diary. My name's Alice.
Which was widely known to be a cautionary tale about a 15-year-old who runs away from home and starts doing drugs.
No jobs anywhere but plenty of dope. How you pay for it, something else.
They didn't read the book in its entirety. They said, here's an excerpt, Steve. So these are the words of Alice. Quote, it might be great because I'm practically a virgin in the sense that I've never had sex except when I've been stoned. So what I did as a 17-year-old is I opened the book and I'm searching for this excerpt.
He found that in context, that passage had a completely different tone and meaning. Here's what followed the excerpt.
I'm practically a virgin in the sense that I've never had sex, except when I've been stoned, and I'm sure without drugs I'd be scared out of my mind. I just hope I can forget everything that's happened when I finally get married to someone I love. That's a nice, secure thought, isn't it? Going to bed with someone you love.
Then there were the school board's problems with "A Hero Ain't Nothing But a Sandwich" by Alice Childress,
which was also made into a pretty famous movie. The book was banned for two reasons. First, because the word "ain't" appears in the title. And the second reason was a passage from the book spoken by Nigeria Green. Nigeria Green was a black teacher in a Harlem school in the book. And he said,
"We all know that George Washington was a slaveholder, but he was also
first president of the United States.
Also the father of
his
country."
Is that right? Oh, George was a father. He sure got around, didn't he?
The school board said that the passage was anti-American because it spoke disparagingly of one of the founding fathers. I lived in an all-white school district, and that's why James Baldwin was targeted, and Alice Childress, and Langston Hughes, and Richard Wright. They were targeted because they were minority ideas in a suburban white community.
Shortly after the book removal, Pico got in touch with the American Civil Liberties Union.
I told them that I knew of the book banning, that I was upset by it, and that I wanted to challenge the constitutionality of it.
I have to say, it's kind of mind-boggling that you, as a high school student, your first reaction would be, "I would like to challenge the constitutionality."
I think when people get involved in a personal way, in an intense way with any issue, it's almost meant to be. I was born to be the plaintiff in this case.
He was very thoughtful, very sophisticated for a high school student.
This is Arthur Eisenberg, one of the lawyers responsible for crafting the legal arguments that would end up before the Supreme Court.
When we heard about the incident collectively at the New York Civil Liberties Union, our impulse was that this is a case of censorship in violation of the First Amendment.
The ACLU had Stephen Pico encourage four other students to join him as plaintiffs, including at least one who was young enough that he or she would still be in the school system should the case drag on for a long time, which it did, 5 years. He chose Russell Rieger, age 17, Jacqueline Gold, 16, Glenn Yer, 16, and Paul Suchinski, 14. Arthur Eisenberg began representing the five students after the district court ruled in favor of the school board.
The school board comes into court and says, "Yes, we censored these books because they are inconsistent with our political philosophy, because they are anti-American, anti-Christian, anti-Semitic, and just plain filthy." But the school board's argument was, "We are the democratically elected body to make judgments about curriculum and the contents of the library." That was at the heart of their argument. And that was accepted by the district court. And so when we had to take an appeal, we had to explain why that theory was wrong and why the First Amendment was violated.
Eisenberg used a couple different legal theories, but the most prominent one, the one that would feature most in the Supreme Court case, was this.
We argued that school officials and school boards have some discretion regarding the curriculum and regarding what is taught in the schools, but they cannot exercise that authority in a way to impose a narrow orthodoxy of views and values, and they cannot exercise that authority consistent with the First Amendment in an effort to suppress ideas that they don't like.
Ultimately, the Second Court of Appeals bought the argument.
So we won, and the books were to be returned. So it was the school board that appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court to intervene.
The issue here is not the books. What's at issue here is local control.
This is Frank Martin, who was one of the leaders of the Island Tree School District at the time, speaking with CBS after they lost in the Court of Appeals.
Does the courts decide what books go into a school library, or do the local taxpayers and locally elected a school board, their representatives, select what goes into the schools?
While they were waiting for the Supreme Court case to begin, Pico upped his media game. Since he'd first sued the school board, he'd been a guest on the Phil Donahue show, he'd spoken at press conferences with Kurt Vonnegut, Alice Childress, and some of the other authors whose books had been removed from the library. much of this while he was a student at Haverford College.
I worked my butt off throughout my entire college years to make sure it was kept alive in the media, that people knew the stakes.
From the very beginning, it's clear that your intention was to challenge the constitutionality of removing books from school libraries. But then many years later, when the Supreme Court chose to hear the case, there was a chance that the court might make it constitutional and would sort of supercharge this kind of censorship. Was there a moment when you were nervous about what you'd gotten yourself into?
You bet. You're exactly correct. You're very astute. I thought we would win the case, but then in 1981, Potter Stewart left the court.
Justice Stewart resigned after nearly a quarter of a century on the court.
I'm pleased to announce that I will send to the Senate the nomination of Judge Sandra Day O'Connor of Arizona Court of Appeals for confirmation as an Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court.
And it was hailed as this great opportunity for women in America. And I looked at it differently because, yes, there was a female justice, but she was going to vote against me. And I realized that this is going to be a very close decision. The day that we were at the Supreme Court, I was interviewed on all the daily news, the morning shows, and the CBS correspondent said to me, do you really think you're going to win here? And I was like, we might lose 5-4, we might win 5-4, but I'm sure it's going to be a 5-4 decision. And he said, you're so naive. I've been the law correspondent at CBS News for 30 years, and you're going to lose 7-2. You're only going to have Brennan and Marshall on your side.
We'll hear arguments next in Board of Education against PICO and others.
On March 2nd, 1982, the court heard oral arguments from both sides. And by this time, the school board had dropped the whole anti-American, anti-religious argument, and instead were insisting that the books had been removed because of their so-called vulgarity.
My position is initially that an examination of the record, and if the justices choose, the books themselves will indicate that there is absolutely no political motivation. However,
an argument which was rejected by PICO's litigator.
They may say that, and they may want the court to believe that's what went on here, but they did in fact make some very explicit political judgments.
Then, after 4 months of deliberation,
the Supreme Court today sharply curbed the authority of local school boards to ban books from school libraries. The landmark decision split the court on a 5-4 vote, and Chief Justice Warren Burger, speaking for the minority, called the ruling a startling erosion of the power of local school boards.
Stephen PICO and the president of the Island Tree School District were interviewed after the verdict was read.
It's a fantastic decision. It's anyone that respects the First Amendment and the free flow of ideas is overjoyed today.
This is definitely a defeat today. It's a sad day in this country for local control.
But this initial coverage didn't capture the complexity of the decision. This wasn't like Roe v. Wade, where you had one big opinion that a majority of justices signed on to that ultimately dramatically changed the law. In the PICO case, there were several different opinions, none of which received a clear majority. Looking back, Arthur Eisenberg is most focused on two of the seven opinions, one in favor of the school board, written by Justice Rehnquist, joined by two other justices, and one written by Justice Brennan, who wrote the leading opinion in favor of PICO, joined by three.
Justice Brennan essentially said that school board members cannot exercise their authority to suppress ideas that they do not like.
In effect, Justice Brennan argued that students have a First Amendment right to receive information, an idea that had never been extended to school libraries.
He said, in essence, if a school board consisting of Democrats were to decide to ban all books about Republicans and all books by Republicans, that would be impermissible.
Yeah, seems about right.
And Rehnquist turned around and said, if it's a principle which holds that school board members should not suppress ideas they don't like, why is that principle limited to the removal of books? Why wouldn't it even apply to the purchase of books, to the maintenance of the collection?
So here, Rehnquist is saying that Brennan's position could introduce problems for school boards. Like, what about all the books that a school library never had in the first place? Are you really saying that the school censored those ideas as well?
And I don't think Brennan or we had a clear enough answer to that. Rehnquist's problem with Brennan's argument was, it's true, Rehnquist concedes, that if they did it because they don't like Republicans, that would be impermissible. But it's possible they decided not on the basis of ideology and not on the basis of politics, but they made their decision based upon the vulgarities in the books. And that's why I'm dissenting from Brennan's opinion.
The vulgarity versus political question was another big point of disagreement. Justice White, who made the deciding vote, the fifth vote in favor of Stephen Pico and the ACLU, didn't sign on to Justice Brennan's opinion because he didn't think the motivation of the school board had been settled.
You know, I often say that we won the case by a vote of 4-1-4. We had four votes and the school board had four votes, and Justice White couldn't make up his mind, so he sent the case back for trial.
They said that a trial should be held to determine the motivation behind the book banning.
Stephen Pico.
And because the school board did not want to go to trial, they decided to return all the books to the shelves because their motivation in banning the books was clear. I wanted to see these books returned to the shelves, and I wanted a precedent set around America so that this wouldn't be happening again. And
but it is happening again.
Well, it is happening again because progress is slow. And you know that. You know that in the fight for constitutional rights, it takes decades to get things done.
The Pico case remains the one and only time the Supreme Court considered the question of book censorship in school libraries, which is why I'm kind of surprised to not hear it discussed in the press more often. One reason might be that it didn't set a clear precedent. And another is that Stephen Pico refused to participate in a sort of Hollywood mythology that tends to help activists stick in our historical memory.
I've turned down Columbia Pictures. I've turned down the New York Times Magazine section. I've turned down the opportunity to write a book.
Why?
Because I didn't want to be seen as profiting from something that I really cared about. If they wanted to do a movie that wasn't about my personal life, if they wanted to do a serious movie about book censorship, then I probably would have collaborated with them. But they really were looking for a private story. And to me, there is no private story here.
Pico has mostly retreated from the extremely public life of a Supreme Court litigant. Nowadays, he's a painter and sculptor, and he writes for his site artloverstravel.com. As for Arthur Eisenberg, he's never stopped thinking about this case.
People have asked me what my favorite case was in my 4 decades at the Civil Liberties Union, and this is the case because of the evolving nature of my thinking about it.
Are you regretful at all?
Look. We didn't create the law that we would have liked.
His first eureka moment, a new way of thinking about the Pico case, hit him about 8 years later.
When I was working on a case involving the funding of family planning services, where the government said, we're the funding authority, we can tell doctors that they can't talk to their patients about abortion, it occurred to me that maybe this was one of those relationships that should be protected.
Then there was this episode in the late 90s when New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani lost a court case with the Brooklyn Museum when he threatened to evict the museum if it ran an exhibition that featured a controversial depiction of the Virgin Mary.
What they did is disgusting. It's outrageous. You could call it anti-Christianity, but anti-Catholicism in particular. Because
the mayor is saying, in effect, if there's a book in a library that we fund, I can take it out if it is offensive. That is profoundly dangerous.
Ding. That's when the light bulb over your head lit up.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But it was too late.
Exactly. It was a little late for the Island Trees case. But if you look back, when state-funded universities were first created in this country, scholars feared that legislators would use the power of the purse to dictate the content of curricula. And this concern gave rise to principles of academic freedom, which insulated lectures and writings of academics from influence by the funding sources, governmental as well as private. The lesson is this. Just as academic judgments should be left to the academics. Curatorial judgments should be left to the curators, and decisions about the content of library collections should be left to the librarians. And I mention this theory because one of the arguments that the school district made was, look, we bought these books, we paid for them, we can make the judgment that these books are impermissible because we paid for them.
He calls this first idea the academic freedom theory. Here's another legal argument that he thinks might have been persuasive in the Island Trees case.
Public education is not just about reading and writing and arithmetic. That an element of a sound basic education involves being educated in democracy. And ideological diversity and pluralism are foundational democratic values. And democracy rests on the power of reason through public discussion. And the remedy for bad ideas is not coerced silence, it is not censorship, but more speech to correct those errors.
Because one of the things that Brennan did point out in his opinion is that the Supreme Court has invalidated education laws passed by state legislatures.
In one case, Nebraska prohibited the teaching of foreign languages in schools. And in the other case, in Arkansas, there was an effort by the legislature to prohibit teaching about Darwin in schools. And the Supreme Court invalidated both of them.
Either of these arguments, the academic freedom theory or the democratic education theory, might have been effective in the PICO case. Eisenberg thinks they may have helped set a precedent that would have stopped the kind of book removals we're seeing today. If you could go back in a time machine and apply one of these different legal theories to that case, would you?
Yes, I would.
A case that coulda, woulda, shoulda been bigger, more definitive, more precedent-setting. 40 years later, a similar moral panic has taken hold in our discourse and in our schools. Or maybe it just never went away. It's hard not to look at the PICO case and wonder if a different ruling, informed by what we know today, might have been able to save our schools and our democracy a whole bunch of trouble. For On the Media, I'm Michael Loewinger.
And that's the show. On the Media is produced by Eloise Blondio, Rebecca Clark Callender, and Max Balton, with help from Aki Camargo. Xandra Ellen writes our newsletter. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Adrian Lilly. Special thanks to Anna Dorman. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.